who haven't figured this out. This is Journal Club rescheduled a couple of weeks after the fact. Thank you for your patience. Henry, can you mute your phone? All right, great. So this is a discussion of the October articles. This is supposed to be November's Journal Club rescheduled here in early December. Hopefully everybody got the things in the Dropbox for that we'll be discussing today. So I'm joined today by our fellow Paul Werko. He's gonna take the first article and then I'll do the other three. So without further ado, Paul, do you want to jump into the first article on Merlin?
Sure. And I'll share my screen so we can at least look at the journal article as we're discussing it. So hopefully you can see that. So yeah, thank you, Dr. Larson. I appreciate the opportunity to take part in Journal Club. The paper I'm presenting is titled Clinical and Molecular Validation of BAP1, MTAP, P53, and Merlin IHC and the Diagnosis of Pleural Mesothelioma by the folks at Brigham and Women's. So yes, it's another paper looking at IHC markers useful in distinguishing benign from malignant mesothelial proliferations as we slowly creep our way towards not actually having to look at the morphology in making these distinctions. So as background, the authors note that we have IHC stains that are molecular correlates of malignancy, including BRCA-associated protein 1 IHC, which is a correlate for the BAP1 gene, and MTAP, which corresponds to alterations in CDKN2A. They note that the neurofibromatosis 2 gene is also frequently altered in mesothelioma. It encodes a protein called Merlin. There has been limited study of Merlin IHC in the diagnosis of mesothelioma. They also note that TP53 inactivation has been identified in 5 to 10% of mesos. So IHC for P53 has previously been assessed and found to be of limited utility, but using previous thresholds that they called non-biologic. And they note that a recent study found potential utility using empirical thresholds derived from high-grade serous carcinoma. So the study sought to correlate the IHC and molecular results for BAP1, MTAP, P53, and NF2 in cases of pleural mesotheliomas while evaluating the potential utility of Merlin and P53 IHC specifically. And they also put forward a suggested ancillary testing algorithm. So moving to the methods, they looked at 84 pleural mesotheliomas by next generation sequencing, by an NGS panel, including coverage of coding and splicing regions for BAP1, CDKN2A, and MTAP, NF2, and TP53, and correlated the molecular findings with the IHC for BAP1, MTAP, Merlin, and P53, respectively. 57 reactive mesothelial proliferations were used for comparison. BAP1 IHC was scored as retained, so positive tumor nuclear staining or lost. MTAP IHC was scored as retained, which is positive tumor cytoplasmic staining or lost. P53 IHC was scored as diffuse if greater than 80% tumor nuclei showed 2+ or 3+ intensity, considered wild type if it was between 0 and 80% nuclear staining, regardless of intensity, and null with no nuclear staining. And Merlin IHC was scored as retained if there was positive tumor cell staining in any way or lost. The IHC and molecular findings are summarized in figure 1 here. So there's a lot to kind of digest looking at that figure. Of the mesotheliomas, 5% had pathologic alterations in all 4 genes of interest, 32% in 3 genes, 46% in 2 genes, and 12% in 1 gene. 5% had no pathogenic alteration detected by their NGS panel. They postulated that maybe it was due to insufficient cellularity. Rates of pathogenic alteration were 56% for BAP1, 69% and 57% for CDKN2A or MTAP, 27% for TP53, and 68% for NF2. They note that CDKN2A and MTAP alterations were significantly more common in non-epithelioid tumors. For IHC, 1% showed abnormal expression of all 4 markers, 8% for 3 markers, 46% for 2 markers, 37% for 1 marker, and 7% had no abnormal markers. MTAP and Merlin were lost significantly more in non-epithelioid compared to epithelioid tumors. Rates of aberrant staining for mesotheliomas were 54% for BAP1, 46% for MTAP, 52% for Merlin. Aberrant staining was not seen for MTAP and Merlin. There was one case from the reactive group that showed aberrant staining for BAP1 that they thought was likely a mesothelium in situ case. P53 staining was diffuse in 7%, wild type in 79%, and null in 14% of mesotheliomas, and wild type or null in reactive mesothelial proliferations. In biphasic tumors, they note that BAP1 IHC was concordant between the epithelioid and sarcomatoid component in all cases. MTAP was lost in only the sarcomatoid component in 4 of 25 cases, and Merlin was lost in only the sarcomatoid component in 2 of 25 cases. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, like, maybe it would be a useful thing to keep in mind if you're ever doing IHC in a case like this to try to incorporate both sarcomatoid and epithelioid components. But then I realized that if you're seeing an epithelioid and sarcomatoid component, you probably already know it's mesothelioma. So maybe that's not such a useful tidbit. Molecular IHC concordance was assessed in cases of mesothelioma. BAP1 was concordant in 86%. CDKN2A MTAP was concordant in 77% and 87% respectively. BAP1 and MTAP IHC staining patterns can be seen in figure 2. P53 was concordant in 80% of cases. P53 IHC staining patterns with associated mutations can be seen in figure 3. The molecular IHC correlations for each case can be seen in table 1. So there we go. So kind of a breakdown with showing the specific molecular alteration. After performing the correlation, the authors determined that null pattern IHC staining should be classified as non-aberrant. NF2 Merlin was concordant in 77% of cases. IHC staining patterns can be seen in figure 4, which is here. Specific correlations presented in table 2. And the authors note that cases with weak granular or cytoplasmic Merlin staining, so retained but aberrant, had a higher rate of molecular alterations, which were mostly shallow deletions, than cases with strong linear membranous staining. Comparison of sensitivities for immunomarkers, immunopanels, and panel NGS can be seen in table 3. So BAP1 is significantly more sensitive than MTAP for diagnosis of epithelioid, but not biphasic mesothelioma. Merlin did not differ significantly from BAP1 or MTAP for diagnosis of epithelioid or biphasic mesothelioma, but adding it to a panel of BAP1 and MTAP increased sensitivity from 79% to 90% for all mesotheliomas. P53 was the least sensitive immunomarker for diagnosis of epithelioid or biphasic mesothelioma, but was the only aberrant immunostain in 4% of cases. And so they put forth a proposed diagnostic algorithm in figure 5 here. Panel NGS detected a pathogenic alteration in BAP1, CDK, N2A, TP53, and or NF2 in 95% of tumors. And they note that those cases with no abnormalities detected had less than 20% sequenced tumor cellularity. So suggesting that maybe if they had enough cellularity, there would be a 100% rate of detecting an abnormality. So discussion, IHC loss of BAP1, MTAP, or Merlin is highly specific for malignancy and mesothelial lesions, including cases where the NGS panel did not identify a corresponding alteration. Adding Merlin significantly improves the performance of the standard BAP1 and MTAP immunopanel. Diffuse staining is of P53 is specific for TP3 mutation and represents the only abnormality in a small subset of mesos. And IHC and panel NGS are both highly sensitive for mesothelioma. So kind of in summary, Merlin seems like a useful marker if you were to add it on top of BAP1 and MTAP. P53, perhaps not so much, but it's a common marker we all have in house. So it's something, I suppose, if you're doing IHC to try to determine benign from malignant, you might experiment with it. But yeah, I'm not sure I would consider it super useful. So that's the paper in a nutshell.
Hey, thank you, Paul. You know, I have a question to that Merlin. I don't know if anyone has experience with Merlin, but looking at figure 4, maybe you can walk us through. But it seems like B is expressed, and it's not a nuclear marker, it's a cytoplasmic and membranous marker. And then D looks a bit wishy-washy to me, and F, I guess this is showing loss, but there is still some weak cytoplasmic staining. I mean, how reliable is all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like, I don't like markers when it's not, you know, it's either strong or not expressed. So kind of when you're getting into the even slight staining counts as retained, it makes me a little uncomfortable myself. But yeah, they kind of going back to the methods, what did they say? Scored as retained, so irrespective of distribution or intensity. So any staining counts as retained.
So then F is retained?
So in that diagram...
No, I mean in the figure four.
Yeah, I'm looking at figure four.
Yeah, they still say, staining.
They show, they say for figure four showing negative NF2 staining. So, oh, that's neuro... So sorry,
oh, it's NF2.
That's the problem. Yeah, they mixed the... they're showing specific examples where the Merlin stain was useful. Oh, wait, that's NF2. And showing negative lost NF2 immunostaining. I don't know why they labeled it that way. But yeah, they're saying that that's lost figure four or for F. So I don't know. Maybe they're interpreting that as like background staining, or it's not actually the tumor cells that have any expression. But I agree with your point there. I have trouble from that small picture deciding if that's actually in tumor cell nuclei or in the cells, tumor cells.
Interesting. Is anyone using Merlin already?
No.
The other question I had regarding P53, and maybe I missed that, because I thought there are two different papers out there. One says you could use P53 if it's overexpressed, but the null pattern, maybe it's this paper, but the null pattern is not necessarily associated with malignancy. And another paper shows that both patterns, the null pattern and the overexpressed pattern, is associated with malignancy.
Yeah, the issue was in this case that they saw null in some of the reactive mesothelial proliferation.
Oh, okay.
So they said it wasn't useful on that basis.
So we probably should not use the null pattern as a marker for
malignancy,
they said only overexpressed.
They said that the diffuse pattern was specific in this case, but null not.
Thank you.
Any other comments? All right. Thanks, Dr. Werka. That nice discussion. Nice paper. So let's move on. Let me see if I can share my screen. Technologically challenged. Obviously. Okay, let's see. All right. Can you guys see my screen? I hope.
It's coming.
Can you see the paper?
Yeah. Now we are. No. Yes.
Whoa. Too big. There we go. Can you see the paper now?
Yeah.
Okay. So thanks. So the next two papers I'd like to share, they're both clinical papers, which I think are important for us to be aware of what's really going on in the world of pulmonary medicine and chest radiology, and highlighting, I think, some opportunities for us as pathologists and also maybe some threats, if you want to think of it that way. The first of these papers is from the Blue Journal from October. That's a deep learning-based outcome prediction in progressive fibrotic lung disease with HRCT imaging. And this is only one of two papers that came out this last month looking at AI tools in imaging that can be used to come up with a better, more reliable, more predictive diagnosis in patients with fibrotic ILD than traditional methods of evaluation of imaging. And so I just am going to talk about one of these two AI imaging papers today, but it's to me, these are interesting things that are coming out the power of AI and deep learning as a tool to perform a more robust and at the same time less biased assessment of morphology is really interesting. And when it's applied in the radiology world and potentially in the pathology world as well. So I'll do my best to walk you through this paper since it is a clinical journal. I probably won't do it justice, but the basic idea is this. So what these investigators did was they first took patients from the Australian IPF registry as their cohort. So it's a sort of a well-characterized cohort of patients with coming in with initial diagnoses of presumed IPF, not all of whom ended up proving to have IPF after multidisciplinary discussion, but it is essentially a fibrotic ILD registry with lots of patients of IPF and then other things as well, as you might predict, chronic HP, CTD-related ILDs, et cetera. And then used these patients and subjected them to this imaging algorithm that they developed using deep learning and AI. So I'll kind of walk you through what they did.
Hey, Brandon?
Yeah.
Were you sharing your screen? Because it's black, at least for me.
I can see it.
I'm sharing my screen, yeah.
I can see it.
Weird. Okay.
So I'll first describe the AI tool and what it does, and then I'll tell you what they did. So what this AI tool does, if you can see figure two, what they do is they use the chest CT scan, and then the computer will take four random slices from the CT scan at one of four different levels. So the lung is divided into basically four quadrants minus the apical 10%, which is ignored by this algorithm. And then one slice from level one, one random slice from level two, one from level three, and then one from level four are grouped together in a four slice montage. And then the AI tool that has been developed to classify these as a probability of UIP pattern or lack thereof is generated. And this can be repeated multiple times in one patient's HRCT scan, producing multiple different unique four slice groupings or montages, each of which is subjected to the AI tool independently, which comes up with a probability of UIP score, a percentage probability. And then this is repeated up to 500 times on a patient's imaging study. So, and then all of those probability scores are averaged together to come up with this global AI created probability score, probability of radiologic UIP based on the model that they created. So, each patient in the study will have his or her imaging subjected to this kind of AI analysis to come up with this probability score. And then what they did was used this AI created probability score and compared it against a probability score that was basically determined by a group of chest radiologists looking at imaging the old fashioned way, so to speak. So, and then the performance of the two probability scores, they were compared with each other. So from the Australian IPF registry, they got 504 patients who met criteria for inclusion in the study that had HRCT scans that were of high enough quality to evaluate. Of these 504 patients, 50% of them were patients with IPF. And then the other half were patients in whom the multidisciplinary diagnosis of IPF was in question. Maybe they were chronic HP, CTD, or other, or unclassifiable. So it's a mixed bag of clinical diagnoses here, all coming from this IPF registry. What they did from a radiology standpoint is two radiologists looked at each CT scan and each patient, determined the total ILD extent, the extent of four radiologic patterns, GGOs, reticulation, honeycombing, and consolidation, extent of emphysema and extent of traction bronchiectasis, and use this to come up with a probability of the UIP pattern, which they somehow estimated in 5% increments. So it's 10% likely or 45% likely to represent the UIP pattern by a combination of all these radiologic parameters. And it's not exactly clear how they came up with that estimate, that 5% incremental estimate of probability. But in any event, once the radiologist had reviewed all these and all the cases were also subjected to the AI tool, then they compared the performance of these two methods of determining probability for a bad outcome with each other. And I'll just sort of cut to the chase here. They basically used an assessment of transplant-free survival. That was the endpoint that they used, looking at probability of transplant-free survival between the cases that were classified by traditional radiology and cases that were classified by the AI tool. And it turns out that on their multivariate analysis that included age, sex, disease severity, and guideline-based radiologic diagnosis, the AI tool was the only method that continued to predict survival. The AI tool could predict likelihood of transplant-free survival, and the radiology reads did not in their analysis. One of the interesting things that they also did, they looked at the cases that were determined to be indeterminate by expert radiology review and consensus, and the AI tool that they developed remained prognostically significant even in those patients that had indeterminate radiology by conventional evaluation. So even in those patients where traditional radiology seemed to be unhelpful, this model seemed to be helpful, at least from the standpoint of predicting transplant-free survival. And then the last thing they did was actually evaluate those patients who had a surgical lung biopsy. Of the 504 patients, 86 of them, so whatever that percentage is, I didn't do the math, but 15-20% of the patients had a surgical lung biopsy. And in that subset of patients who had also had a surgical lung biopsy, this AI tool was the only method that was predictive of mortality or transplant-free survival, including histology evaluation. So with some limitations and caveats, this type of study is interesting. What it tells me is AI tool is actually superior to traditional assessment by radiology and pathology, or at least that was the conclusions that the authors had made. Whether it can be used as a replacement for radiologists or pathologists remains to be seen. The one thing that I noticed in this paper, at least from the standpoint of a pathologist, they mention here the subgroup that had surgical lung biopsy. Of those 86 patients, 53 were called UIP and an additional 16 were called probable UIP on histologic analysis, representing like 75-80% of the cases. And to me, that's a little unusual. I don't know that I would necessarily classify 80% of my fibrotic lung disease cases as probable or definite UIP. My experience is that there are an awful lot of cases that are more indeterminate or unclassifiable from a pathology standpoint or airway centered, et cetera, et cetera. These numbers seem a little bit skewed towards UIP. So maybe that explains why pathology was not predictive of transplant-free survival in these patients. If they were all called UIP, then there's no discrimination from that information. But that's just my own guess. So discussion about this paper, I just wanted to bring it forth to help us to be more aware of what's happening out with AI and image analysis in the radiology world and how it might potentially affect us. Brandon, surprising?
Thanks. Not completely surprising. I mean, you're getting a better look at the whole lung, that's for sure. Whether they're all UIP or IPF is a little bit hard to say, and it would be interesting to know, I mean, Wendy Cooper is the pathologist, but it would be good to know the quality of the of the surgical lung biopsies. Were some of the probable ones just because there was insufficient tissue? Do they all have two lobes? How many slides were reviewed? And I glanced at it. I didn't see that kind of information in here, but those are the sorts of questions about the pathology end of it that would be interesting to know.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. I also wonder, this over 80% of the cases in this study did not have any pathology. So you never know what you're not seeing. It's interesting that it's predictive. How much of this is simply a reflection of disease stage versus true underlying biology? I guess we'll never know. But does it matter to does determination of etiology matter anymore? Or is it all just about stage and risk of progression? I guess we don't know that. So with that, it's, I suppose, a reasonable segue to the next paper that I want to highlight today. Also from the clinical literature, this is from European Respiratory Journal. Sorry, let me pan to the top of this. So this is the largest cohort of so-called progressive fibrosing interstitial lung disease that has been published and basically characterizing what is progressive fibrosing interstitial lung disease, sometimes called progressive pulmonary fibrosis, PPF, is sort of a general category. In the clinical world, as you all no doubt know, there has been a shift towards classifying patients phenotypically rather than with traditional disease type diagnoses, into basically progressors or non-progressors. Because now that, in-build and other trial data has come out that indicates that patients who progress can be given antifibrotic therapy regardless of underlying etiology, it's become increasingly important to determine whether or not somebody is a progressor or a non-progressor from a clinical phenotype standpoint, and maybe less important to determine what the underlying etiology is. At least that's the direction the winds are blowing in the field. But it has progressive fibrosing interstitial lung disease, or progressive pulmonary fibrosis, whatever your favorite term is for this, has not been very well understood or well characterized from a clinical standpoint. So what this study aimed to do was to characterize patients with this clinical phenotype, this progressive phenotype. So what they did was they used the Canadian Registry for Pulmonary Fibrosis and examined the clinical parameters, clinical phenotype, progression in 2,746 patients in this registry, all of whom had fibrotic ILD. Which, like the last study we just discussed, had a mixture of etiologies or presumed etiologies by multidisciplinary discussion that included patients with IPF, included patients with fibrotic HP, included patients with CTD-related ILD, even unclassifiable cases or sarcoid and other random odds and ends, asbestosis, and lumped them all together and then just looked for features of progression. So in this study, they used the parameters, I believe, that were originally proposed in the in-build study, but to define what progression meant. And for them, this was progression within 24 months of diagnosis. That was the time definition they used. And then the criteria that they used to determine whether or not somebody was progressing with a progressive phenotype was either a decline in FVC of at least 10% within 24 months, death, lung transplant, or any two of the following three things: either FVC decline between 5 and 10%, worsening symptoms, or worsening fibrosis on chest CT. which seemed a little bit subjective, but those were the criteria they used to call somebody a progressor. And then they basically looked at the potential contribution of factors to the progressive phenotype. So just before I mention the factors that seem to be associated with progressive phenotype, I'll just mention that the progressors themselves seem to occur among all different clinical diagnoses. So for example, people who were labeled as IPF in the cohort, 59% of those patients with IPF progressed. Patients who had fibrotic HP, supposedly, 58% of those progressed in the 24 months, almost identical to the patients with IPF. Unclassifiable ILDs were a little bit less, 51% progressors, and patients with CTD-related ILD progressed in 45% of cases, so a little bit less. Yeah, 59 in IPF, 45 in CTD, but still a pretty significant number of patients, even with CTD, who progressed by their criteria that they chose within the 24 months of diagnosis. So baseline characteristics that were associated with a progressive phenotype. So patients who were older tended to be more progressing. Men were more commonly progressors than women. Patients with a smoking history and a higher cumulative smoking history were more likely to progress. And patients with some kinds of comorbidities like GERD or GORD, if you're in Europe, people with GERD, GORD tended to be more likely to progress, as did patients with ischemic heart disease. And people who started out with lower baseline pulmonary function testing parameters tended to progress more often than patients who had better lung function at the time of their diagnosis. So I don't think any of those are really that surprising. The criteria that were met to call somebody a progressor, they actually looked at which criteria were fulfilled by patients who became or who are progressing in the 24 months. The criterion that was fulfilled most often was actually the relative decline in functional vital capacity, at least 10%. That occurred in about half of patients. That's how they met criteria for being called a progressive phenotype. Then the other thing they did was here's the progression by diagnosis. So I've already mentioned this, but IPF patients were the ones who progressed most often, but it was only in 59% of patients with IPF that actually showed clinical evidence of progression within 24 months. The authors suggest that this might be due to the fact that this is really all comers in the registry, and about two-thirds of these IPF patients had been treated with antifibrotic agents during the time period of the study. So, you know, does that explain the somewhat lower percentage of progressors compared to what, you know, has been reported in the literature in patients with IPF in the past? Maybe. But this rate of progression is very similar to patients with fibrotic HP, a little bit higher than those who have CTD ILDs. And the patients with other things like smoking-related ILD, sarcoid, et cetera, had a much lower rate of progression, although not insignificant. Almost 40% of those patients did progress in the study period as well. The hazard ratio for progression compared to IPF, patients with HP in this study had an almost identical hazard ratio for having progression, 0.96 compared to IPF. Patients with CTD-related ILD, their hazard ratio was 0.65 for progression compared to IPF, so much lower. So that's basically this study in a nutshell. Lots of clinical parameters, and this mixture of patients, a mixed bag of diagnoses. I don't think that this is totally surprising. We know that patients with fibrotic ILD of whatever sort, all of them have risk of progression. This is the first large cohort that's been reported in the contemporary era with antifibrotic therapy, which gives you a sense of what we're actually dealing with nowadays. I think that's helpful. Whether or not this will continue to be useful clinically, this idea of progressive pulmonary fibrosis compared to non-progressive pulmonary fibrosis and how this will impact patients over the long haul, I think remains to be seen. Are we going to reach the point where nobody gets a biopsy anymore because imaging is better than radiologists and pathologists? And are we going to reach the point where the etiology doesn't matter anymore? If you're a progressor, you're going to be treated one way. If you're a non-progressor, you're going to get something else. I guess we'll have to see where this goes. But I can understand why the field is going in this direction. But I think there's some opportunities for us in pathology when I read papers like this. It may just be my own personal opinion. Maybe others have other ideas. But what can AI tools do in pathology to help leverage the value of a biopsy clinically and maybe help us to better understand these diseases that all sort of end up destroying the lung, but are undoubtedly heterogeneous in their biology? So just a couple of comments on these last two papers. Any other folks have thoughts or comments that they'd like to share?
You know, I don't know if it has been done, but I guess it would be interesting to look at if any of these, or I mean our own patients, would undergo biopsy, whether there are some morphological differences in these patients that are progressors versus the other ones. And the other question, it seems like they did not tease it out who had antifibrotic therapy, but that would be interesting to compare the people who had antifibrotic therapy versus the ones who didn't and look at their progression or non-progression.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think they got into that from what I recall in the study. I may be wrong. Maybe I'm forgetting something. But I totally agree, Anya. That would be really interesting to know.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of confounding factors here as well. You know, painting with a broad stroke, they might be missing out important details. Like you said, things that we might be missing out, certain patients that have IPF that don't progress, that are males, et cetera, but there's something else going on. And then what is IPF? It's really just an exclusion of everything else. And we know we can't always exclude hypersensitive pneumonitis. So it's a little bit of a chicken and the egg thing here as well.
Yeah, we really do need better biomarkers to separate biologies from each other in a clinically meaningful way. The field is begging for some discovery.
Absolutely. And if we're not getting the tissue, I mean, they want to do biomarkers on blood all the time, but I think tissue is where it's at. So if we're not getting tissue to look for biomarkers, I think that's a loss. And, you know, your first paper, they talked about AI is better than the pathologists themselves. But what was AI picking up that pathologists were missing? To me, that's the most interesting part.
Mm-hmm. Now, what would happen if you added AI to the pathology? What would that provide to the picture? Sort of makes me wonder. I couldn't agree with you more, Margaret.
And also the pathologists are very variable as well. So some pathologists, you know, 50% of pathologists will call something IPF and others won't. And so, you know, there's so many variables and these are very, I think these are early days.
Yep. All right. Thanks for your comments. We just have a couple minutes left. I'll just share very briefly the fourth paper with everyone. It's mostly as a for your information kind of article. I don't think that there's anything here really groundbreaking other than just the fact that this is the largest series of localized mesothelioma in the peritoneum that's ever been published. You know, I don't know that I've personally ever seen a case of localized peritoneal mesothelioma, or if I did, I have forgotten about it. Maybe others have had those cases, but they are very rare, as you all know. This group from MD Anderson managed to cobble together 18 cases of localized peritoneal mesothelioma in women over the course of 43 years, and then basically characterize them from a clinical standpoint, from a pathology standpoint, from a molecular standpoint, immunohistochemical standpoint. Basically, they look like mesotheliomas anywhere else. They look like that from a stain standpoint, from a molecular standpoint. They have molecular abnormalities that are similar to diffuse malignant mesotheliomas. And similar to what has been described in other cohorts of localized peritoneal mesothelioma, about just over half of their patients had local recurrence, local and or diffuse recurrences. 20% of the patients had tumor progression, and several of their patients died of disease, which we know does occur after a diagnosis of localized mesothelioma, whether it's in the thorax or the abdomen. Some of those patients do go on to progress. One thing that was interesting in their study, over 75% of patients had some kind of irritating abdominal thing in their history. So either prior abdominal surgery, diverticulosis, endometriosis, inflammatory bowel disease, or things that might suggest an underlying etiology. Only one patient had a direct reported exposure to asbestos, and a couple other patients had reported secondary exposure to asbestos. Nobody had a talc exposure in the study. But the only other thing I'll mention from this study, a couple of these cases had interesting morphology that could trip you up in some cases. Most of them had sort of a typical look of mesothelioma, epithelioid and or biphasic. Biphasic was less common, but in figure 4 and figure 5, it illustrates some of the more unusual patterns that they saw. One patient had a very distinctive clear cell morphology that didn't look a whole lot like mesothelioma, but did stain like it in the end. One had these sort of tubulocystic growth pattern areas with blood lakes in it, and a couple of cases had adenomatoid-like areas with microcystic and macrocystic patterns. So just another interesting thing to note in these cases, but just thought I'd bring this up in case any of you see peritoneal cases. Undoubtedly, colleagues bring them to you because you're the mesothelial expert in your group, so at least it seems like that tends to be the case. For peritoneal things, our GYN colleagues always bring them to us. But just to be aware of this paper about localized peritoneal mesothelioma. All right, any comments on that paper?
Appreciate it, Brandon. Thanks. All right, well,
yeah, thanks everybody for joining you, this morning. Have a great holiday when you get to it.
You too.
Thank you.
I think we meet next week.
Is it next week?
Thanks. Yeah, that could be.
I think, I don't know who's doing December, but I think we have a meeting again next week. So, but thanks, Brandon.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.